The theater. The theater.
Bring out Louis.
Theater. Theater.
To be or not to be.
Theater. Theater.
It's a holly jolly Christmas. How's everyone doing?
Oh, Jesus.
Doing all right.
Yeah?
I'm doing much better now that Hanukkah. I'm talking with people.
Yeah. This, generally speaking, I can often be in a foul mood before we start recording and generally feel good when we're done because I like you guys. And, you know, I love you and stuff.
Yeah, likewise.
But fuck this. I am going to... you're fine.
Yeah,
Christmas, man. Jesus Christ. It's unrelenting. Like, it's unrelenting. I'm about to go on... what? Like a 6-straight-day run of stuff. All holiday-related.
Yeah.
You know, and it's fine. It's not horrible.
And your birthday.
And my birthday.
We gotta shout out your birthday.
Yes.
Happy, happy.
By the time you hear this, it will have already happened.
Yeah, turning 21. How does it
turn
feel?
Turn in 21. I'm going to drink for the first time.
Is that right?
And you guys are going to be there. You guys are going to be there to watch me drink for the first time.
I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah.
God only knows what I'll be like.
God only knows what Scott will be like. Drunk for the first time. The first time. I have a question for y'all, because I've been kind of I've been building my list of Christmas movies and holiday movies I want to watch leading up.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of an advent calendar of movies.
Yeah,
that's a good idea.
Yeah, and I was just wondering, like, what are your movies? Like, what are your Christmas movies? What are the ones? Because we watched White Christmas and we didn't really talk about this. And I was like, shit, we should have.
Yeah. I have a few. Miracle on 34th Street's a great one.
The original or the remake?
Oh, the original.
Okay.
The original. Yeah, for sure. It's a Wonderful Life is always sort of a standard thing.
Okay.
The Alistair Sim version of A Christmas Carol, which I think was 52, something
sure.
like that.
Yeah, I've seen that.
Those are kind of the big ones. Then I get in A Christmas Vacation.
Yeah,
which
I love Christmas
is still,
Vacation.
Vacation is still hilarious.
It's a big one for me.
Yeah. And it's oddly still holds up. Like there's a few problematic
jokes in there.
Yeah, but just
I have a
couple.
Problem with the cat dying. That bugged me since
That's
I was
tough.
A little kid and
That's
I
tough.
Haven't liked the movie
no, it's
since
the best
because
part
of
the
I know
the
well,
That's
I,
a really hard
I just remember the first time when they walk in and she had wrapped the cat in the box.
Yeah,
it's like
that's, tough.
That's so mean.
It
I just have always been a cat lady. That's why.
I think those would be Elf is up there.
Oh, Elf's good.
Elf's
That's
fun.
A good one.
I like the Grinch Who Stole Christmas, the cartoon.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I can't watch the Grinch, the Jim Carrey one, which I'm not disparaging. I think it's a fun time, as I recall. But if you
Ron
guys
Howard.
Ever heard, yeah, but if you guys ever heard the story about him and the makeup.
He, like, became an actual Grinch, right? Because the makeup was so uncomfortable.
They had to bring in a CIA prisoner of war expert to train him on how to distract himself from the discomfort. But it would be 8 hours a day of putting on and taking it off alone, never mind the time that he had to shoot. And he did, and that's why he won't ever do a sequel. He's like,
what's the sequel? What's the fucking sequel to the Grinch?
There is another. There are a couple of Seuss Grinch stories, but that aren't holiday related.
Okay,
yeah.
I mean, I always every year have to do A Christmas Story. I think we did discuss that.
Oh
briefly.
Yeah, of course.
I know it's not a holiday movie, but I always end up watching Sound of Music around Christmas time.
Sure.
I have to say, if y'all feel like trying out something new, the one that came out a couple years ago on Netflix, The Christmas Chronicles, was pretty damn good.
Hmm.
I enjoyed that one. And then, honestly, like this year, I should probably get into it because I'm experiencing some pre-holidays anxiety. I had one year where I sat down and just would randomly pick shitty Lifetime and Hallmark Christmas movies. Sure. And they're all like cheesy and ridiculous, but that's why you watch them. And I always have a blast when I'm watching them. So maybe I'll get into that these next couple weeks too.
Okay.
What about you, Bailey?
Die Hard as well. Die Hard counts for me and my dad.
Yeah.
So. Iron Man 3, anything by Shane Black.
Iron Man 3. Okay, yeah. Okay. The Good Guys? Does The Good Guys take place at Christmas?
Probably. The Nice Guys.
Nice Guys. Sorry.
Yeah. It probably does, yeah. I don't know. I do really like the Muppet Christmas Carol.
Oh, it is good.
I think it's really solid. One. We just put it on the other day and Iggy really liked it, but it's just like a solid flick. Christmas Vacation's huge in my house. And then like we're also, you know, we really like vibe stuff. Mm. So it's like Christmas vibe without it being Christmas, like Ever After. Or like
things that came out at Christmas.
Yeah, things that definitely would have been a December release that like we would have seen around the time. I saw a movie recently that I will be making a new holiday tradition out of watching, which is The Holdovers. Okay. That's going to be kind of one of those like, I'm going to put this on. It's Christmas time. Yeah, things like that. I don't know. I'm trying to think. I feel like I have one that's like my big one and it's not. Oh, well, Christmas Story. It's probably a Christmas Story.
Mm-hmm. I have to say, if anyone is feeling like a lesser known Jim Henson musical movie, it came out in the early 80s. It's called The Christmas Toy. And it's all Muppets, but they're all Muppets that you've never seen before. And it's like a 40-minute long musical. And I remember watching that every year when I was a kid. It's a good one.
Yeah, Christmas
Toy. Dark, but it's a good one.
Yeah.
As all children's things should be.
Yes.
Dark and good. welcome to Theater, the theater podcast for theater nerds, made by three theater makers from the LA theater scene. I'm J. Bailey Burcham.
I'm CJ Merriman.
And I'm Scott Leggett.
That's right. And each week we get together to discuss and debate the definition of theater through various lenses. And we are currently covering Shakespeare's problem plays. We're doing three of them. Last week we talked about Measure for Measure, which was a good ep.
It was good.
My mind was changed about that play just chatting with you all about it.
Yeah. And then this week we're covering CJ's pick, Cymbeline.
Yes.
And next week we'll be doing Winter's Tale. Am I right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, you got it.
Yes. And CJ, real quick.
Yep.
Tell us why you chose Cymbeline.
So I did it probably like 15 years ago. It was my second year up at Theatricum Botanicum. I got cast in it and rehearsed and performed it for 6 months. So I spent a lot of time with this play.
Sure.
I was originally called for Arviragus, which is one of the stolen princes.
One of the two brothers,
But I didn't get it, which it's a cool part. I wish I would have gotten it. But instead, they cast me as the doctor, which is Cornelius, but they called me Helena instead. And I made a meal out of that part. And I haven't interacted with it since then, but like I mentioned before the episode, I think I'm going to be on an island here because I still really, really liked it a lot. So I really loved it, even though we did it for 6 months. I loved it from beginning to end working on this play. So, yeah.
Nice. Sweet. Nice.
How about y'all?
What's your history with it, Scotch?
Virtually nothing. I had said last week that I've never seen it, and I thought I had never read it, but in reading it, I'm like, so what I suspect happened was that I was assigned this in college and probably just grabbed my Shakespeare A to Z to get through it.
Sure.
But I don't remember sitting down and reading it. But did this time, I started it and then stopped and I went and watched. Have you guys ever checked out Shakespeare Finger Puppets?
No.
Series? It's great. No. It's really quite brilliant. So it's basically summations of Shakespeare plays done with little finger puppets. Mm. And it takes about 5 or 6 minutes and they just sort of lay out what's going on, the general gist of what's going on.
Sure.
But even for this one, they were changing costumes on the fingers as they were going, and they're like, okay, so this guy's now this guy, and she's now this guy, and she's this is this.
Shakespeare really should have written this into a TV series instead of a play.
Right. but once I got the summary down and kind of remembered things, I'm like, and then I cranked through pretty quickly. It took me two sittings to get through it, but and I got a lot of stuff to say about it, but I'm glad I did it. And thanks for bringing this one in, Siege. What about you, Bales?
I love this play. I saw it years ago, and then Shakespeare Youth Fest has never tackled it, but it's the one that we're always sort of like, and one day we'll do Cymbeline. we'll do it someday. Maybe even next year, I don't know. But it's really fun, and it's bawdy, and it's queer, and it's more populist, I think, in terms of, like, at the time, I think it was a more popular play than maybe some of his other ones, but I just like it. I've always liked Cymbeline. I think the three of us might be, quote unquote, on an island, CJ. I don't think a lot of people love Cymbeline. In fact, we'll get into like a few of the critics that it has, including Shaw, George Bernard Shaw, who
the
had
man
some,
that writes impossibly long plays.
Yeah, it had some really intense, harsh words about it, which we'll get into. But yeah, I have feelings about it, but it also, like, just like I do with any Shakespeare play or any Greek play, I'm like, ugh, those times. But then also, like, I think there's ways to update it. I think there's ways to make it more interesting. I think there's ways to make it really, like, you know, queer theory based and more for our modern audiences. But yeah, I like this play a lot. And there's a lot of movies, a lot of movie versions of it. I've never seen any of them.
Really?
Yeah, but there was one in like 2015.
There's like
really
an Ethan Hawke one. Yeah, I don't know what he played. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have a lot of thoughts about how to stage it and what you would do and how you would do it.
Yeah.
But it very quickly became apparent why it's a problem play. By the definition of the problem play.
Yeah.
Not problematic, but just a problem. Because you can't, it doesn't, you know, it's well, I guess technically a romance, if that's where some,
but there's some historical war shit in there too.
There's and historical shit, there's tragedy, there's
somewhat
comedy
on reality, so it's this weird kind of course. Yeah. Like some people say Titus was too, right? Sure. Like Titus Andronicus had its like basis a little bit in reality. Lear had a little bit of basis in reality. It's based on another story that's based on another a real king that was at a different time, you know, whatever. And so, yes, but it doesn't fit into any of our categories
at all.
Yeah.
You know, it's,
I would compare it to Pericles in that it just covers this vast, I mean, Pericles is more a vast amount of time, but I feel like this covers so many spaces and people, and you're bringing new characters in and act four and shit like that. So
yeah,
it's hard to keep up with if you're brand new to it.
Yeah,
it's got a fairy tale kind of element to it where you can feel like, you know, he's drawing on magic stuff. Well, then Jupiter shows up.
Right.
The Jupiter shows up, the god. And so, yeah, it's in doing my research and just kind of, you know, scanning, like, you know, people's feelings on it, the phrase "a glorious mess" was used a lot. Yeah. And I'm like, yeah, it is. It's
to
messy.
Be fair, when I did it, all of the Jupiter and the dream and the soothsayer was completely cut from our version of it.
Boo!
Yeah.
Boo, what's the point?
Listen, I didn't do the cutting of the play. I just auditioned.
We use the Jupiter scene and that big monologue as like beginning Shakespeare stuff during the summers when we do intensives for new kids. That's like one of the first things. It's like a big group thing that you can do where they're all being like, you know, the harpies of Jupiter or whatever, you know, like,
it's pretty fun. Yeah.
So it's something I know really well just from that. Just from like doing it with 50 different groups of kids over the last few years, you know. I think we learned, I think we did it in Kenya. I think that was like one of the first things we taught them was like this Jupiter speech. We were like, this is simple. They'll get it. They know some lore based around this kind of stuff. It was good.
Word. Should
that should be the podcast.
CJ, should you break it down and then we can start talking about some of this stuff?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
CJ's breakdown. Bear with me. Imogen, daughter to ancient Britain's king Cymbeline, is in deep shit because she married below her station. An almost adoptive family member and servant to the royal family, Posthumus. She was supposed to marry her new whiny dipshit stepbrother, Cloten, son of her hot evil mother-in-law.
Hot.
Now banished Posthumus brags to horny douche Iacomo about how virtuous his wife is, causing Iacomo to accept some kind of challenge he's made up in his penis brain. Iacomo visits the Briton court and, still chaste but overtrusting Imogen, manages to successfully lie to Posthumus about fucking her, thus throwing the whole story into a tangled web of running away, a breeches role, kidnapped Briton princes turned into mountain men, dipshit wannabe racist Cloten getting his stupid head cut off, and oh yeah, the Romans are marching on Briton because they won't pay their taxes. How the fuck could this ever have a happy ending?
A simple children's story. Cymbeline. Yes.
Cymbeline.
I'd like to start off by being a dick and taking a position.
Be a dick.
Bring it.
Take a possession.
If Imogen would have listened to her father at the beginning, none of this would have happened because he was right. Posthumus not only was below her station, he's also just kind of an asswipe. He's just kind of an asswipe of a protagonist. He bets his wife. He bets on her. He goes along with the bet. On her chastity. Like, he's not the guy. She should have just run off and just run off and never come back.
There
like,
is
it would have been better.
What you're saying, I think Shakespeare also feels mildly there is this sort of like, and also listen to your parents.
Sure. No, I'm being,
he's also doing a little bit. Yeah, because I think he's also doing a bit of the, what he does so well with R&J and you know, the Lear, what's her name? I'm losing her name in Lear, the youngest, Cordelia. Those characters that are people who want to, you know, break out of that and want to challenge things and want to challenge their parents and be their own person and do all these things. But there's tragedy surrounding that usually, right?
Yeah.
Well, and may I give my rebuttal to what Scott said?
Sure,
yeah.
I see Imogen as, compared to a lot of the other like young women ingenue types, she has a whole lot of agency and she's very self-possessed and she's not scared to stand up to people, which I really dig about her. And I wondered if like one of the big questions that this play is asking is the idea of marrying for love as opposed to marrying for duty. Because if she had listened to her dad, then she would have married Cloten, and Cloten fucking sucks too.
Cloten super sucks. He's a super
but,
sucker.
But also, what a whiny little dipshit. Like, all of his scenes are fucking hilarious. And the thing that I love about this play, I mean, I love a lot of things about this play, but the thing that I love about it too is the lords and gentlemen that come in that have a ton of great scenes with him and these fucking hilarious asides to the audience. Like, there's just a lot of great roles in here, whether large or small, in my opinion.
Yeah, and I do think that Imogen is the crux to this whole thing. This is the thing that's the character that's gonna last, you know.
For sure.
And that's the hero, in my opinion. That's who you're rooting for the whole time. I think Shakespeare puts her in some weird, uncomfortably not funny but funny positions. Alas, what happened to your head? Like, it's just like, how would you deliver, like, how do you deliver that, like, and not have it be funny? But yeah,
I remember when we did it the gal playing Imogen, she was just so fucking emotional at this point that the line never came off as funny to the audience from my memory. Yeah. She was just so racked with tears and shit, thinking her husband was dead.
I just wrote in my notes, Clotten is a weenie.
He is. He's a weenie. He's a fucking whiny little. He's not like Kylo Ren of Cymbeline.
Yeah. I kind of wanted him to be really malicious, like really dark. Like I wanted him to kind of push it, and I kept trying to look for sort of layers, like in the way that I looked at Angelo in Measure for Measure. Like,
sure,
he's an evil, you know, hypocritical dipshit. But he's asking himself the questions. He's challenging himself. He fails at that. But Clotten just never, you know, he never becomes anything more. Like, give me some teeth. Like,
yeah, yeah. You,
no, it's just like, no, dude, go back, go back to your mom, who has no name. The queen. We
got the evil queen. I love her though.
All of these motherfuckers got 19 names and costumes and different people that they're supposed to be, but the queen's just the queen.
Yeah. Yeah. She's great too. It's a great character.
It's a great character. Yeah. Yeah.
Like I said before, there was a lot of criticism of this one by some of the people that we like, mm-hmm. Specifically Shaw, but Samuel Johnson. Who's the 18th century critic, poet, and lexicographer.
Oh, my.
He dismissed its unresisting imbecility.
Zing.
And George Bernard Shaw, who liked All's Well That Ends Well as much as Shaw liked any of Shakespeare's plays, he called Cymbeline stagey trash of the lowest melodramatic order.
There is a feeling that when reading this, keeping in mind that it was towards the end of his career and how fast he often would have to crank out stuff in order, you know, because he's running a theater, he's got to get shows up. And part of me is like, did he just like kind of grab the source material here and was like, here we go. Let's do with it what we will. There's another quote from another critic that I read who feels that it was Shakespeare doing self-parody for the first time, that he's just bored and is like, I'm going to make fun of my own shit. And
right.
You can kind of see that at times.
I mean, there's a few other critics that enjoy it or at least are less harsh on it. Now, Shaw did rewrite. He did his own Cymbeline.
Oh, really?
Shaw wrote a Cymbeline refinished, is what he called it.
Okay.
Just him rewriting the ending of it. Okay. And it's like real short. I think it's like a 10 page. I don't think it's like super long. But then Henry James, who was a critic in 1896.
Okay.
He said, Cymbeline is a florid fairy tale of a construction so loose and unpropped that it can scarce be said to stand upright at all, and of a psychological sketchiness that never touches firm ground, but plays, at its better times, with an indifferent shake of golden locks in the high, sunny air of delightful poetry.
Brilliant. That's fantastic. Yeah.
I thought it was well written.
I was like, yeah, it was so well written. And like, yeah, like I really now do want to see this because I think that there's a lot you can do with it. I was reading and a lot of productions apparently do, or recent productions have been very meta. Like, it's very much, we are actors telling you a show. Come along with us and check out this show because it's wacky. And so there's a little bit of winking that's going on, but then it helps set up that fifth act, which is, in comparison, it's not a great act. Like, it's not quite
the final scene of the show is crazy. It's yeah, so long it's and like, so many things so happen. Many,
like, and all that. But like, if you have actors, you know, somebody was like, if you double cast it and you have actors on stage switching costumes going, yep, I remember when that happened and I can verify that bit of information. And
right.
Yes, I saw that plot point. Then you can, you could have a lot of fun with it in a very meta way, I think.
I remember sure. when we were still, when we were getting to the end of rehearsals for this and we were in that last scene, and as Cornelius, it's, everyone's trying to figure out how they thought Imogen was dead and how she got away, and this is where the doctor comes in and says the thing about the poison thing.
Mm.
And it's literally, the line is like, not literally, but it's like, oh my God, you guys, I forgot and I just remembered. Like, that's what the line is. And it's in the middle of all this who, what, and drama, and they're pulling someone away to jail. And I remember the first time I delivered that line when it came to me, when she had just told us where Ellen Gear had just told us where to stand, I blew that line out with comedy big time. And everyone on stage started laughing. And Ellen was like, no, 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 you got to do it this way. So you can blow it out of the water with comedy. But I think the thing that worked for us, because we did it up at Botanicum Theatricum, and it's this, for those of you that don't know it, it's this big, beautiful, like 400 seat amphitheater in the middle of the fucking woods in the Topanga yeah. Canyon. And like, I love the ancient Britain of it all too, personally.
Oh,
and
yeah.
so does that group of people. And that's what they did. We did like that time period. And in that place where you have mountain men in it and everything, it just works. Because half of the guys that work at Theatricum Botanicum are actual mountain men. Mm-hmm. So it really worked in that setting too. So,
right.
But I would love to see a meta version of it. That would be fun as fuck.
Yeah, I mean, you could play with it. I Bailey, I love that you brought up the queer representation, the queer stuff that you could play around with and subvert.
Sure.
A lot with it for sure. Yeah.
Well, because you know, we're playing with all the genderqueerness of it all anyway, which you know is all over Shakespeare and it's its own thing, and people constantly are discussing the fact that because men weren't able to, or because women weren't able to perform, that you know, now we get to switch all that around and everything. But the play, you know, obviously has a lot to do with sexuality. We're dealing a lot with virginity, chastity, mm-hmm. all this kind of stuff. But when we're talking about like heterosexual norms, there's like this kind of open discussion about, like, at the end there's some kind of maybe non-heterosexual possibilities,
mm-hmm.
if you know what I'm talking about. And I don't know, I was reading about it and now I'm forgetting like all of it. I should have taken some more notes.
Right.
But there's basically a lot of people who, I'm trying to remember her name here. I'll find it. It's like Judith Butler, I want to say. Yeah. Judith Butler and Eve Sedgwick are these people who do a lot of queer theory kind of stuff. And they talk a lot about the Ovidian illusions throughout the play and exploration of non-normative gender and sexuality. And they call these green worlds. Have you ever heard of green worlds?
No.
Mm-mm.
I don't know what this is, but I was trying to figure out more about it. But the most frequently cited examples is like the prominence of homoeroticism throughout the play with Gerdius and how do you say their names?
Guiderius and Arviragus.
Them. Guiderius and Arviragus. But they have like this sort of sexual fascination with Imogen disguised as Fidel.
Mm-hmm.
Fidele.
Yeah.
How do you say his name?
Fidele. That's Fidele. How you said it.
Mm-hmm. And you know, I
Which
just
means
things like this.
Truth.
Oh.
It's a good one. It's a clever little Shakespeare name.
Yeah.
Well, and when we did it, Arbelarius was played by a woman. Arviragus was played by a woman. I wasn't a sexy character, but.
I read about a couple productions. I read about a couple productions where the brothers are are switched, or it's brother and sister, mm-hmm. that they're siblings instead of strictly brothers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Some people have even gone as far as to talk about there being some kind of like trans, or identifying trans, but more like hermaphroditic type things with Imogen talking about, like, with her lines. There's this line that always gets kind of brought up in these discussions, and it's her saying, "Oh, what am I? A mother to the birth of three, ne'er mother, rejoice deliverance more."
That's Cymbeline that says that, a mother to the birth of three.
Right, but they're talking about, like, specifically, oh, maybe then that's what they're talking about. But even, maybe it's him. Mm-hmm. But even so, there's kind of these discussions of, like, male, paternal feelings about sexuality and about gender and all this. I don't know. Save me, guys. Yeah. I'm going.
It's cool. And I think that that's what intrigued me the most, was that, oh, this is open. And the fact that it doesn't have a shadow looming over it, like so many other Shakespeare's, you know, Hamlet has a shadow, you know, Othello, all of the big ones have shadows and legends and all that. Like, there's not a lot of famous Cymbelines that come to my mind. Some of the film versions, but that leaves it open. It's like you kind of have this, it's kind of like discovering a new Shakespeare or an undiscovered Shakespeare in a lot of ways, because it's been done enough that we have proper analysis of it. And, you know, I think, you know, more complicated and in-depth analysis in terms of just the queer folks that you were just talking about, Bailey, where you can go, oh, I can really tear this apart and fuck with it on almost every possible level. And it's okay. Who's going to come fight you?
Well, and I think something for me that I have to say, like, reading this, I was crying. I don't feel this way about any Shakespeare plays when I'm reading them. And at the end of every show, I was crying, because there's something at the end of this, and I don't know if this plays into what you were talking about, Bailey, but there's something about the end of this play that there is so much more acceptance and forgiveness and an opening of arms to people, even the people that did quote unquote bad things. Iacomo is forgiven. I love the line, live and deal with others better. I love that fucking line.
Yeah.
But the fact that they let the Romans free at the end and tell them to come party with them, like, the fact that Belarius is forgiven for kidnapping the princes so long ago. Like, I just remember getting to the end of this play every night and thinking, this is the way that people should be to one another, instead of, like, the bad guy gets what's his, which is satisfying in a lot of ways. But there was something that was even more satisfying about the end of this show to me.
I wrote down a CJ quote when I finished writing, which is, if everyone would have just gotten in a room and talked this, we could have solved all this from the beginning. We could have just talk it out.
And that's what they do at the end of this, it's really nice.
Okay, I just want to read this little bit is talking about, so they're talking about paternity and hermaphroditism. Mm-hmm. In arguing that that line that I quoted earlier, that Cymbeline's line, amounts in a parthenogenesis fantasy. I don't know what that means. In taking sole credit for the creation of his children, Cymbeline acts a hermaphrodite who transforms a maternal function into a patriarchal strategy by regaining control of his male heirs and daughter Imogen. Imogen's own experience with gender fluidity and cross-dressing has largely been interpreted through a patriarchal lens. Unlike other Shakespearean agents of onstage gender fluidity, Portia, Rosalind, Viola, and Julia, Imogen is not afforded empowerment upon her transformation into Fedele. Instead, Imogen's power is inherited from her father and based upon the prospect of reproduction.
Huh.
Interesting.
That is interesting.
Yeah.
Anyway, so there's just so much study on this thing because it is so interesting, and there are these people that are like, it's garbage, and then there's these people that are reading it being like, I don't know. There's something here. I feel about Titus, where there's so many people that are like, oh, it's his weakest play, and I'm like, no, that shit's fun as fuck. Yeah. I love watching Titus.
It's brutal and fun and exhilarating. And it, also Titus, at least the productions I've gotten to see, but even reading it, Titus like cranks. Like you can get yes. through that fucker fast. And there's a yeah. lot that happens, but like I said, this I read relatively easily, although it took me 2 sessions for it. I did want to talk about fucking Giacomo. Is
Giacomo?
Fucking Giacomo. Like, what a creepy little motherfucker. Like, it's like, hey, you like watching your buddy's naked girlfriend sleep? Because I do. And like, it's just, it's well, you know, so creepy. And so my initial reaction was laughing at it, like just how creepy it is. But then going, there's a lot you could do with this and say with this and talk about with this in terms of, well, even just the first scene where you meet him, it's like that all the, it's all just bro talk. It's all like, you know,
you know, locker room talk.
Yeah. Chicks from England are hot.
Well, and you know what was interesting when we did it? And again, this is my only basis for comparison is when I did it because I haven't seen it since. The guy playing Giacomo was, Imogen and Posthumus were like in their 30s. And then like their early 30s, mid 30s. Giacomo was, he must have been at least in his 50s, maybe even pushing 60, and was a dude with a booming voice and a whole hell of a lot of gravitas. So like, you can't, I can totally see you casting some bro type younger douchebag dude, but like putting a guy in like that in the role like completely made me view it differently, I guess.
Yeah.
Right. Hey guys, just because I just got the notification, I thought I'd shout this out. This is really terrible. Andre Brower.
Yeah.
Do you know who that is?
Yes.
He's on Brooklyn Nine-Nine.
Yeah.
Okay.
Just passed away.
Oh no.
61. Quite young.
No.
Yeah, he was actually, you know, he did Shakespeare in the Park in New York City. Central
Park.
He was
Henry
V.
Dude. Yeah, he was a Juilliard dude.
He won the Obie Award for Henry V.
Yeah.
You know, if you saw him, you'd know him. He's this guy, Siege.
Yeah, I'm looking at him right now.
Yeah, and he's got a lot of really cool theater credits. He's on BoJack Horseman. He's California Governor Kudchuck Berkowitz.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, Olympic Games. He was the narrator of the introduction of the Olympic Games, succeeding James Earl Jones, from 2006 to 2010. Mm. And he does the narration for the Alex Cross books and stuff like that. He's damn.
Yeah, the first time I remember him is in, the Civil
Glory.
War. Glory.
Yep.
Was him in Glory and right. How brilliant he was in that. Like he,
yeah.
You know, he goes toe-to-toe with Denzel in that movie in a number of ways, and he's fucking great. Oh, man. Well.
Yeah. Anyway, a phenomenal actor, gone too soon. Gone too soon. To get us back to Cymbeline, rest in peace, Andre. We love you much.
Yeah.
But to get us back to Cymbeline, I did find something about the folio listing of this play.
Yeah.
So it's been, you know, it's been argued over. Many critics have put it in their own categories, which is what the problem plays basically are. But when it appeared in the first folio in 1623, it was listed with the tragedies.
Huh.
Hmm.
I have a first folio sitting in front of me propping my laptop up.
Right. But because the funeral dirge that they sing, right, is over a fake grave, no one has technically died.
Hmm.
But it's also not, so it's not really a tragedy. It's not quite a comedy. The Tempest, let's see, like The Tempest and Winter's Tale, it is more accurately described as a romance.
Uh-huh.
And then it says, see, it's just all of these, they're always sort of like, well, it could be like nothing has a definitive answer. Mm-hmm. And I think we just have to decide like as ourselves.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I think with all of the problem plays, at least the primary ones, that's kind of the magic of them. I love that at some point he was going, I just want to try this weirdness, something
he just
different.
Wanted to stretch.
He just wanted to stretch. And yeah, the result is, you know, he's all over the place.
It says it should be, it should most likely be lumped into its own category with two other plays, Julius Caesar and All's Well That Ends Well. As it is set roughly at the same point in European history as Julius Caesar.
Yeah.
And its structure and themes are of the problem play variety, like All's Well That Ends Well. But much like Julius Caesar, it's not based on the exact thing that happened. It's more of like a fun fictional telling of something that may or may not have happened. And then it says the action takes place in Roman Britain, specifically in parts of England and Wales.
Oh,
it's a Welsh play.
Yeah,
it is the Welsh play and centers on the rule of Roman chieftain Cunobelanus, known, of course, as Cymbeline in the play.
Yeah, that's the first thing is he's not really a king.
No,
he's
a king of an area.
Well, yeah, he's a Roman governor. He's kind of, you know, right, bitch to Rome, which is,
yeah.
Well, this is kind of, this is about the early days of Britain. This is, in a lot of ways, it's patriotic.
Sure.
Right.
In terms of, you know, yeah, we're ourselves and fuck you.
Well, and this is just my assumption, and this is just because I've read Mists of Avalon too many fucking times. I take it as the times when you did have those Celtic and Britain kings of smaller areas, but the Roman Empire's moving in and saying, no, actually, we're in charge.
Mm. Right.
So you have to pay us tax. So there's this like push and pull going on. I thought of something that I thought the two of you would appreciate. Has anyone ever done all of the Shakespeare plays, but in timeline order, like when taking all of those stories and putting them when they would have happened historically?
Oregon Shakespeare Festival, I think, finished their run of the entire canon a year or two before, or maybe a year before COVID hit.
Okay.
But they did it in order of the folio.
Okay.
So I don't know. I don't think that counts.
No, I want it in order of where these stories come from.
Yeah,
like,
true. Oh, I see what you mean. Like within the story. I see.
Yes. Yes. Yeah,
yeah. Well, but then where do you put things like Tempest or like? Well, I guess Tempest has a time.
Do you say that's a, maybe you decide like it's a post-apocalyptic
Naples
thing or something?
Millen. Yeah, that's true. Wow.
Midsummer.
It's like all the Pixar movies.
Midsummer's kind of specific.
Midsummer, you could give a time.
Oh, it's ancient Greece.
Athens. It's, yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. That just popped in my, because I was thinking about this in relation, because they mentioned Julius Caesar a couple times in the play, and I'm like, huh, where would this fall timeline-wise from? I mean, obviously, it's coming after, maybe? Yeah, obviously. Yeah. But, yeah, I thought y'all would appreciate that.
Absolutely. We should timeline order watch the entire just it would to, like, be, find all the old BBCs or Royal Shakespeare.
I know. I mean, I know a lot of, I know like the RSC, I think in the 70s or 80s did like all the histories in order for maybe, it might've been for like a coronation anniversary celebration thing. All hail the queen. But yeah, I mean, to do the whole canon and, but then, like, where do you put, like, you know, then there's the, you know, the couple that you were just not sure about. Just not sure about.
But two noble kinsmen?
Two noble kinsmen. Yeah, I don't know.
I only know the Jailer's Daughter speeches from that. Otherwise, I don't know that play at all.
Yeah. No, me neither. Me neither.
There were a lot of different adaptations of this thing.
Tell.
There's Thomas Dufay. adapted one called The Injured Princess or The Fatal Wager.
Okay.
Which was produced at the Theatre Royal Drury Lane.
Whoa.
All right.
By the King's Company in 1682. And it just changes names and details and adds a whole subplot
Which is what they were doing in Restoration Times anyway. They were like, what if there's seven stories? and then...
just inserting a character named Kyle.
Cotton is a fop.
And just
oh, yeah. Yes, actually, it says that here. It says that the subplot is Cotton laying traps for waiting women, and they're all escaping and... dealing with that, so that's kind of funny.
That's fucking
which
cute.
Sounds very it sounds very Restoration. By the way, the best fop performance anyone's ever done ever, maybe ever, period, ever. Check out Poor Things, the new Yorgos Lanthimos film.
It's
and Hulk, what's his name, fucking
Mark Ruffalo
is next level.
I love a
amazing
good
in that movie. Yeah.
Well,
I can't believe I called him Hulk.
And he may have one of the best meltdown, like man baby meltdowns ever. Good. Like, it's extraordinary how far he falls.
Okay. Anyway, I had to bring that up. But then there was one in 1759. There was one George Bernard Shaw did the Cymbeline Refinished, which we discussed.
I would laugh if I found out that was even longer than the original Cymbeline.
Apparently it's pretty short, and he rewrites the last act, cutting the revelations and expositions while also making Imogen a much more assertive figure in line with his feminist views.
All right.
Because Shaw was a feminist.
I love Shaw. I've spent time with him, but He does write long plays.
Man and Superman was like one of those plays that I remember while reading it being like, I'm going to have to start this over. I'm halfway through and I don't understand anything I've read. There's a billion different NBC broadcasts in the 30s and United Kingdom broadcasts in the 30s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s. There's a bunch of radio versions of it. And then in 1930, they make a movie, Lucius J. Henderson, who, if you look up his IMDb, made like 500 films.
Damn. Just one of those guys. That's
how,
it's how they did it. It's like all those short films and stuff. They were just cranking them out. It's kind of amazing.
Once you're in the biz, you're in the biz.
Yeah. He did like that really famous Jekyll and Hyde, Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde in the 20s, I want to say.
I've seen that.
Yeah, like the really famous early one. And then he also did, I think, a Merchant of Venice around 1912, before this. And this that gets him the money to make this. Anyway. There's a 1937 BBC broadcast. There's a 1968 adaptation for Polish television. There's a BBC Shakespeare 1982, which ignores the ancient British period setting in favor of a more timeless and snow-laden atmosphere inspired by Rembrandt and his contemporary Dutch painters, which sounds fucking rad, starring Richard Johnson and Helen Mirren as Imogen.
I'm horny now. Thanks. Thanks a lot, Bailey.
Exactly. It sounds great. And then in 2014, we got to watch this, y'all.
Yeah.
The cast is fucking incredible. Ethan Hawke and director Michael Almerieta, whose name I'm probably saying wrong, but he did the Hamlet that Ethan Hawke did in 2000.
Okay. Sam Shepard.
You're talking about?
Yeah.
I'm guessing Ethan Hawke played Posthumus in it.
Ethan Hawke is Cymbeline.
Oh, he's Cymbeline. I guess he's.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. No, Hawke is Iachimo.
Oh, all right.
Yeah. It's set in like urban gang warfare. It's kind of weird. All right. But Ed Harris is Cymbeline.
Oh, rad. Yeah.
Penn Badgley is Posthumus.
Okay.
Mila Jovovich is the queen. Anton Yelkin, in one of his final performances, is Cloten.
All right.
And Dakota Johnson is Imogen.
All right.
Oof. Oh, he might have just lost me.
Oh,
I know. That's what I was about to say. She's not really my cup of tea. I like her in like... She has that one scene in Social Network. I really like her in Peanut Butter Falcon. Everything else I've seen her in, I've been a little bit.
Oh, I keep forgetting about Peanut Butter. But the rest of it, like, she's kind of dead-eyed. Have you seen the trailer?
Which should have been a
Webb?
Fucking massive hit. She's bad in it. Oh, yeah. The Madden Web trailer looks kind of bad.
Oh, my God. Looks so bad.
Twitcher, make Sydney Sweeney that part and Dakota Johnson somebody else.
Yeah.
It's fine.
Anyway, and then but I'll watch it.
Yeah, I'll probably still watch it. There's a stage adaptation called Dinah in 1894 by Edmund Mesa. Anyway, I just wanted to get those out of the way because they're kind of interesting.
People have been doing it.
And then the only other thing I wanted to make sure I mentioned is that I do have a daughter named Imogen. And apparently, according to, by all accounts, this is the first time that name ever appears anywhere ever.
Oh.
What? Really?
There is cool. Well, because there's a Gaelic name, Inogen, which is I-N-N-O-G-N. But when they say it, it sounds like Imogen.
Mm-hmm.
It's Inogen. And it means girl or maiden. Or whatever. And I apparently that name is featured in a lot of Raphael Holinshed work, which is something that Shakespeare really plundered over and used a lot of. So a lot of people believe it was a printer's error of the two N's actually becoming an M, which is interesting. But people still relate it to the Inogen, the Gaelic term. So it's sort of considered like a Celtic or Gaelic name, although it may have only been created by Shakespeare.
Does Inogen have any relation to the word ingenue at all?
I bet it does. I'm sure it does, in fact. Let's
ingenue
see.
Ingenue is French.
Yes. I just wondered because you said like maiden or young girl, and isn't that kind of what an ingenue is? I mean, I guess it's morphed into just like young leading female, but
I don't know. Yeah. But I should give, we should give a shout out to Imogen Coco.
Imogen Poots.
Imogen Coco. Do you know what I'm talking about?
No.
Oh, she was a huge actress. So most people know her from late TV and stuff. She was the grandma that dies in the original Christmas Vacation movie.
Oh, of course.
They have to strap on the roof. She's amazing. Insane. But she did. She was like a queen of like early 40s, 50s television. And she was a huge theater actress. And then she makes a famous appearance in The Brady Bunch.
Oh, okay.
Of course.
Special guest star on
The
Brady Bunch.
See, my first was our organist at my Lutheran church, except she was called Imogene. And there was a rumor going around for the entire time that the pastor at the time was there, was that Pastor Johnson and Imogene were having an affair.
Oh.
And I just remember as a kid thinking, like, I can't imagine two weirder or less interesting people being interested in each other and then having sex.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Imogene.
Yeah, some organs were getting played, if you know what I'm talking about.
That's exactly right. There's also a whole, like, you know, there's a lot of Imogene with an E at the end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Imogene.
Or there's even, I knew someone growing up named Emma Jean. Mm. Like E-M-M-A-J-E-A-N-E. No, it was a G. I don't remember her middle name. Anyway, Imogene. And like things like that, but Imogen is,
I love
also
Imogen,
the name of from Fried Green Tomatoes. Her name
right.
is Imogen,
yes.
And that's where we've named our child after. Anyway,
it's a nice. Good name.
It's a good, I solid, approve. Sturdy.
Yeah,
sturdy it's gonna take name. Her far. It's gonna take her far.
Gonna take it real far. Okay, what else do we want to, is there anything else we need to talk about?
I just want to say that men's vows are women's traitors.
Oh Lord, turn it down a notch, Anne Hathaway.
I still remember that line being yelled out and me just being backstage going like, girl.
I think it kind of surprised me. I was like, because true story, just because of the way my brain works, every time I hear or see the word Cymbeline, I think of Thumbelina.
Sure.
You know, the
as one does,
tale,
yeah.
Yeah.
Thumbelina. And so
I think I did
they were
too,
in my
actually,
head.
Really.
They were mixed in my head for a long time.
Yeah.
But yeah, I would be really excited to try and direct this someday. Like,
cast,
you know,
me. I want to play like almost all of these roles. So
no, we're gonna go in a different direction, but thanks. Gonna keep your head shot though.
You gonna pull my Arboregus again? Damn it.
Aww.
Bailey, you can be in it.
Oh, what?
Thanks.
Oh, play fair.
CJ, you can choreograph the dance number that's at the very end of the play. People are going to be pissed that they're watching because they've just been watching Shakespeare for 3 hours and they really got to take a pee. Yeah.
Sounds hard.
Yeah, it does.
I just remember getting cast in this show and finally hearing the title of the show and then thinking like, oh, that's how you say that. It was one of those words. It's kind of like I didn't say the city name Van Nuys until I heard somebody else say it.
Sure.
It's like, oh, that's how you say that. Okay, good. I was too scared to say it out loud.
Cymbeline.
Kimbeline, Kimbeline,
Kimbeline, Kimbeline.
I'm just a dipshit from the Midwest, y'all.
Yeah, that's true. I am too. It's okay. And we love each other for it.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, okay. Do we want to spotlight some LA theater before we get out of here?
Yeah, we probably should.
Fuck it.
LA Spotlight.
Man, I got a couple different things. I want to give a shout out to Allie Miller and Cherry Poppins. They're doing their holiday burlesque show at the Bourbon Room in Hollywood. And I think it's going to go through this weekend. So as this airs, you still have time to go see it. Go check out Cherry Poppins online. Instagram is a good source for it. And then at the Broadwater, playing also through this weekend, that you're listening to this, is She Loves Me. You know, She Loves Me. Musical. And
I like She Loves Me.
Yeah, I've been hearing it through the walls as I've been working at the Broadwater, and it sounds pretty cool.
Hey.
I'll give it a shot. And then just in terms of other LA theater, there's a ton of sketch and variety holiday shows happening at the Broadwater. Follow the Broadwater on Instagram, the Broadwater LA, and just check out shows. You can come see shows. There are sketch shows that are $5 and less than 40 minutes long. Like, come get a drink, see a funny holiday show, and, you know,
enjoy, go get another drink.
Then go get another drink.
Love it.
Yeah.
I love that shit.
Yeah.
Theater isn't dead.
No.
It's not.
Quite alive.
No, some of it.
It's regenerating. Mm-hmm. I'm in Doctor Who mode. Excuse me. It's bi-generating. And not to reveal too much, CJ.
Yeah, don't.
But you're going to be so happy with what happens with David Tennant.
I hope he dies and Matt Smith is the one that kills him.
Oh my God.
Wow, Jesus. No, it's almost the exact opposite of that.
No.
It's almost the exact quite, opposite.
Does that mean David Tennant kills Matt Smith?
Yes,
no, I'm
correct.
Just saying it's a very loving, healing, cool thing.
Does he apologize to what's-her-name for gaslighting her for that whole season and a half?
No, because this doctor's a different doctor. He's the 14th doctor now.
Quit.
Educate yourself, CJ. Educate yourself. But
this
seriously,
podcast is dead.
New Doctor Who.
Podcasting is dead. Theater is not.
I think it's true.
Yeah.
All right.
All right. Well, bye. What else are we spotlighting?
I'm spotlighting Nobody Fucking Bug Me during the holidays because I'm going to be sitting at home in pajamas the whole time.
All right.
Can cut that.
Okay. No, I'm leaving it.
No, I'm going to post your address, though, and phone number.
Docs.
Yeah, I don't have anything. Just look for stuff in the new year. There's a lot of really exciting things happening. We obviously have the Shakespeare Youth Fest happening in March. And then Fringe. Next year will probably be very fun. So I'm excited about that.
Yes.
I'm producing at least two shows between now and then. So.
Oh my God. I realized my original sound wasn't on that whole time. It's going to sound like shit.
It'll be fine.
Well, now it sounds really weird.
Yeah, all my shit's coming in the new year. So I'll start punching after that.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Next week, we got one more shakes.
We got one more shakes. Thank you for joining us for part 2. Of our problem plays, we covered Measure for Measure, Cymbeline. And next week is Winter's Tale, not the Colin Farrell, Russell Crowe movie. Has nothing to do with this.
or but does
you can
watch it?
That anyway, because it is bad, though.
Theirs is Tale, T-A-I-L.
You're right. No, it's not. It's not. It's not. It's just a bad movie. Okay, but we'll be done for a while, till sometime next year. So we love you guys, but we'll see you next week.
Do y'all have questions or comments? Please reach out to us via email, Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter. Scott?
Thank you so much, CJ. A big shout out to Ryan Thomas Johnson, who writes our stingers and our theme song. And our theme song is better than your fucking theme song. Suck it.
Cunts.
Yeah.
Whoa,
cucks.
Fuck. Oh, my God.
And then finally to the late award-winning playwright Errol Pinter, who writes every single one of our episodes, and he doesn't even know it. And one day, Errol Pinter, in heaven, we're going to buy you a drink.
It's true. Some sake.
I would love it
sake.
If you enjoyed
out
sake.
Out of a thimble, yes.
Or some soju.
Subscriber review, it really does help. We love you guys so much. And Scott, I'm about to send you something. If you could just read this in your best Ewan McGregor Scottish accent.
Okay. The first thing I see, oh my God, it's so long. Choose life. Choose a job. Choose a career. Choose a family. Choose a fucking television. Choose washing machines, cars, compact disc players, and electrical tin openers. Choose good health, low cholesterol, and dental insurance. Choose fixed interest mortgage repayments. Choose a starter home. Choose your friends. Choose your leisure wear and matching luggage. Choose a three-piece suit. On higher purchase in a range of fucking fabrics. Choose do it yourself and wondering who the fuck you are on Sunday morning. Choose sitting on the end of that couch, watching mind-numbing, spirit-crushing game shows, stuffing fucking junk food in your fucking mouth. Choose rotting away at the end of it, all passing your last in a miserable home. Nothing more than an embarrassment to the selfish, fucked up brats you spawned to replace yourselves. Choose your future. Choose life. But why would I want to do a thing like that? I chose not to choose life. I chose something else. And the reason? There are no reasons. Who needs reasons when you've got heroin? The font was pretty small on that, but I got it. I got that.
That was that poster of just that monologue was on my wall all through high school. My parents.
I used to remember it all. Yeah.
That's from Trainspotting, for anyone.
Okay. From Trainspotting. Yeah.
It's in the book and the movie.
It's beautiful.
Fucking heroin.
I needed that. Thank you.
Yeah. Choose a fucking big television. All right.
Bye.
You gotta say later, everybody.
No, I gotta wait for you to sing.
That was the song.
Oh, I was doing the song. Yeah. I got it. I'm slow.
It's okay.
Later, everybody.
The theater.
Theater. To me.